Iditarod Dogs and their mushers are nearly 24 hours into the 45th running of the race. For the third time in the race's history, the official start had to be moved to Fairbanks because of low snow conditions in the Dalzell Gorge. There's plenty of snow in the interior, and today on Talk of Alaska, champion Libby Riddles and competitor Lisbeth Norris will discuss the past, present, and future of the last great race.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Iditarod time is great for so many reasons. The excitement of the ceremonial start in Anchorage, the only American urban center that closes streets to allow dog teams to run through the city. Visitors and mushers from all over the world. The marvel of men, women, and dogs, so tough they can run 1,000 miles to Nome. And the return of more daylight hours caps it all nicely. I'm excited and honored to have one race legend join us today. Libby Riddles, the first woman to win the Iditarod, is on phone from Homer. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Lori. Hey, good morning, everybody. Nice to be here.
Thanks so much for being on. And unfortunately, we had planned to have Lance Mackey on the program also, but found out this morning that he is homesick. And Lance, if you're listening, please feel better. We're all rooting for you to feel better and be back out there. We'll hear some of an interview with Lance from the official start in Fairbanks later in the program. Lisbeth Norris also is on the line. She is joining us from KUAC in Fairbanks. Lisbeth has raced 3 times in the Iditarod. Her rookie year was in 2014. So Libby was a rookie in 1980, and Lisbeth was a rookie in 2014. So we have a terrific range of experience. Hello, Lisbeth.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on. And you, Alaskans, can join our conversation if you have questions about race strategy, the dogs, changes in sled technology, or you just want to speak to some icons of the race. Give us a call. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about some race strategy for this year. I imagine that you're both studying the reports of trail conditions. Libby, what do you think mushers are in for this year?
Oh, I don't really know much more than anybody else, having not been out there, but I'm just following the reports and the updates, and it sounds like the trail's probably better for the mushers up in front than in the back, but I had to just check the tracker before we went on the air. We're all just glued to see what's going to happen.
And Lisbeth, what are your thoughts about it?
Oh, I'm in about the same boat as Libby. I'm paying attention to the race reports and the run times. I came back from Nanana late last night. I was handling for my friend Monica, and the river trail sounds good, but that could change in an instant.
It sounds like there's some really deep snow in places. How tough does that make it? I try to envision what it's like to be out there sort of breaking trail with your dogs and a sled, and I can't imagine how exhausting that must be.
Well, it gets worse the further back you get.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the trail can get chewed up, but you have to kind of train for it so your dogs are used to going in soft snow a little bit, too.
So are you both saying that it's harder, it's easier to be in the front? Because that seems to me like that would be the tough place to be, is in the front of the pack instead of in the back. But it gets more difficult when the trail gets churned up. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, after 50-something mushers. So there is an established trail. Iditarod has a great set of trail breakers that put in a fantastic trail every year. And when you have 40, 50, 60 dog teams run over that trail with their drag mats, it can break down the base. So the teams in the back are often left with softer, slower conditions.
Libby, When did you last run the Iditarod?
I think in like 97 or something. No, 95. And then I went up quite a bit of the trail with Norman Vaughn's first serum run group in 97. So, yeah, quite a while ago, huh?
So did you, you didn't ever start in Fairbanks then, the restarts?
No, and I've never been to the start up in Fairbanks, but I sure think it's great that that's an alternate plan for when the conditions are bad here. Everybody's had so much snow around the state, it's a little hard to get your head around the fact that there's none across the mountains, but I guess that's how it is, so.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the Iditarod today. Our guests are Libby Riddles, and she's on the phone from Homer, and Lisbeth Norris is on ISDN from KUAC in Fairbanks. You can join our conversation if you have questions about the race, about the dogs, about the sleds, or past races, what the future might look like. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. Or in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Lisbeth, what do you think about the start in Fairbanks? How does that possibly change the race dynamic? Does it favor certain mushers?
Sure, it favors the mushers in the front that still have a packed trail. And with such deep, heavy snow conditions this year, passing will be a serious challenge. You know, there may be a set trail running along the river, but you step off to the side of it and it's bottomless snow. And so it takes a real disciplined and well-trained team to be able to pass cleanly in those conditions. And it's my understanding that Iditarod has put in some passing lanes as it is along the trail, but still passing is going to maybe bog some teams down, slow some teams down. And the same once they start traveling overland through the portages, those are pretty, they're not frequently used trails, so they're quite narrow, and passing will be a challenge there as well.
Libby, anything to add about that? I know that you said you hadn't been to the start in Fairbanks, but what are your thoughts about going through the interior there and how it may favor certain mushers?
Oh, I think it's a favor for the speedsters because in some ways, and also it's not near as technical, not having the Happy River Steps and the Dalzell Gorge. So I think anybody that runs it as a rookie has to come back and do it the other way to really get their full taste of Iditarod. And really, it's hard to say who this is going to favor. There's so many factors in that, with people's training and preparation. And, you know, they're all in the same boat to some extent. You know, sometimes the trail is worse for the people behind. There's other conditions where the trail actually will set up for the people behind. I just like kind of checking out the different characters in the race this year. A lot of interesting people, a lot of really tough competition, a lot of innovation from Dallas Seavey's new sled, where he's got compartments to carry the dogs in the front because you can't do it in trailers anymore. And, like Jeff King's fancy sleeping bag parka thing he's got so he doesn't freeze to death on the Yukon, because that is cold. I mean, I definitely think that trail is going to be colder than going the traditional way.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I do want to talk about some of the things you've touched on, the Dallas CV and what those innovations may mean for competitive edge and also some of the changes this year. But what about the cold, first of all? Mushers are no strangers to extreme cold, but how will that be a factor?
Iditarod mushers, maybe. I really think that a lot of the Iditarod mushers may struggle with the deep cold. It's not something, it's not like Yukon Quest run in the middle of February up in the interior. And deep cold isn't something that a lot of Iditarod mushers are necessarily used to. So there may be a bit of a learning curve there.
Well, let's ask someone who was a rookie in 1980. Did you experience a lot more deep cold earlier in the race, Libby, than what people may be experiencing now in the Iditarod?
I tell you what, when you're out there in the country up in Alaska, you're crazy if you're not cold in some conditions. I mean, that's just the wildest weather. But when you're out in that day and night on the dog sled, you know, or when you live out there and that's how you get around. I mean, that's just crazy dangerous sometimes, and you really have to know your stuff. You have to be mentally prepared for it and to be very, very careful, and you really have to know how to take care of your dogs and that stuff. So they were just talking about even Jeff King, you know. He's usually a guy who wants to have that comfort of staying at the checkpoint, and in this race route, the checkpoints are farther apart, and it's generally serious cold up there on the Yukon, so... We'll see. We'll see what happens. These guys know what they're doing, most of them, a little bit. We'll find out which ones don't, I guess.
And is that, for both of you, Lisbeth and Libby, is that what you'd be mainly concerned about if you were on the trail this year, is this the cold that they'll be experiencing?
There's so many things you have to be prepared for. It's just taking care of your dogs in the cold, don't you think, Lisbeth?
Yeah, it adds... you just have to be so much more careful, and you have to make sure that metabolically the dogs are being taken care of, because they require so much more calories just to maintain their body weights in such severe conditions.
Oh, that's an excellent point, yes. How much do you think the changing climate and unpredictable snow and unpredictable weather conditions will affect the future of the Iditarod?
Time will tell, I guess. I really don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
I just think it's nice that we have the flexibility to go to Fairbanks if we need to, so we can still have a race. I hate seeing the fur rondy canceled, you know, things like that, where they don't really have a backup plan unless they want to do it out of town. But at least with the Iditarod, they've been able to, so far, improvise over 45 years of different types of weather to get her going. So that's pretty admirable, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lisbeth?
Yeah, I agree with Libby.
Yeah. 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation with race legend Libby Riddles and Lisbeth Norris, who has also been a past competitor, and we're going to be talking about what else they're up to with dog tourism businesses in the show. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK statewide. Or if you're in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. If you have questions for the mushers that we have online, you can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. When you're racing, how much do you focus on strategy, and what else do you focus on? Libby, when you were running the Iditarod, what were the main things that you focused on?
I don't know, just trying to do everything as best as you can. But, you know, I try to have a solid plan with a little notebook with times, you know, like what I would recommend to somebody who's a rookie, too, even, is like to study who is like the 20th place musher, you know, on the route that you're going, and study those times and how they ran it and have a plan, you know. But then on the same token, you have to really look at your own dogs, what they're capable of, how they're doing, and then balance it, you know. And for me, my strategy was always just to kind of do the best I can. I didn't really have a plan better than that.
Lisbeth, how about you? What was your focus? Was it strategy, or what else did you really focus in on when you were racing the Iditarod?
My focus has always been to get a happy, healthy team to Nome. And I am not, it's no secret that I'm a back of the packer. So I'm not an ultra-competitive musher, and so my race strategy is run according to the abilities of my dogs. And I do come up with a race schedule, you know, like it's really an ideal race schedule. And then you have to be flexible and roll with the punches, because you never know what the trail's going to throw at you. So you may have a race schedule, and it can go out the window in an instant. So you really just have to know your dogs and run according to their abilities.
So flexibility sounds like a really key component. You might have all the strategy in the world, but things change, conditions change, stuff breaks. So you just have to kind of roll with it.
Hey, Laurie, I'll tell you what, when you start that Iditarod, I don't know about everybody else, but to me it just feels like you're jumping off a cliff. You never know what's going to happen. You just hope you're prepared for what it is. And that's part of the fun of it, and the excitement and the adventure. But, hey, for people that don't know Lisbeth, she's a younger musher and a back of the packer, like she said, but still from a very interesting perspective. Third-generation musher from the Norris family, Natalie Norris, who just passed away this year, and Earl Norris, her grandparents. They've had Siberian huskies in Alaska since, like, the 40s or 50s. Natalie used to race with the guys back in the 50s, and both of her parents are racers. Her dad just raced in the Rondi with these purebred dogs, and that's a real tradition that we've had. Now, I think this year, I think it's the first year in a long time we haven't had a purebred team in the race, right? I don't think, is anybody running them?
No, yeah, it's kind of a bummer. The race logo this year is of three Siberians from Yvonne Dobek's team, so yeah, it's a bit of a bummer.
There's some in the race, though. I'm sure there's some
no,
scattered
there's
in
not.
Teams, yeah.
Mm-mm, I, no.
No? No, really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I don't believe so.
So what does that mean? If there's not purebreds in the race, then what's the combination? What are people racing?
Oh, we could do a whole show on that, right? It's just like it's always been like, you know, people have been on the top, you know, tend to have their dogs bred the most of the different kennels. And a lot of the dogs, I think, are kind of having similar pedigrees in a lot of ways after all these years of breeding. But sure produced a super dog. And they all started from, you know, basically things like, you know, the dogs they were using for sprint racing in the Rondies back in the 60s and before that. And then village dogs, and then throw in some of the purebred, too. So,
and Lisbeth, let's, you know, it was great that Libby brought up the history of your family and how far back it stretches, and the fact that your grandmother was running dogs with men before women were entering the race on any kind of a regular basis. So what does that mean for you and for, you know, just the way that you see the world, sort of, through this history that you have, and what it means for you to know that your grandmother was one of those pioneers.
Well, I guess I grew up just steeped in mushing, and I've been influenced by a lot of really strong women in my life, including my grandmother and Libby and my own mom, who was the first European woman to run Iditarod. And I take a lot of pride in like continuing the family heritage and running our dogs. We have the oldest Siberian Husky kennel in the world, and I adore the breed. I think the reason we're not seeing a lot of Siberians in the race is that there just aren't that many people running them anymore. It's really a numbers game. There's a few top Siberian kennels in Alaska and Canada that have been fielding race teams. I would love to see more.
All right. This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Iditarod today with Libby Riddles and Lisbeth Norris. 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. as Tim Johnson did. And I wanted to also let folks know, if you're tuning in past the start of the show, that we had hoped to have Lance Mackey on with us today too, but we found out this morning that Lance is homesick, so we're hoping he's feeling better. We'll hear a little bit from him in a bit of an interview after the break at 10:30. But I wanted to read this email message from Tim Johnson. It says, I lived across the street from Libby Riddles and Dewey Halverson in 1976. Libby was Dewey's dog handler back then. The last time I saw Dewey, he was hawking T-shirts at the Egan Center. The shirt said, Save the Males. And he says, good to hear, Libby. We come from the same part of the country. Great to hear that regional accent. So that's a shout out to you, Libby.
All right. Oh, thanks.
And we're going to go to the phones now. Olga is in Homer, and I think she's going to ask for something that I was planning to get to, but we'll let her take it from here. Hi, Olga.
Hi.
Hi,
Libby.
Olga.
I've heard that there's a story about when you won the Iditarod that you had to spend a night out on a lake in a big storm in a cave, and that you dug, or a hole that you dug or something, and I was wondering if you could tell that story.
Yes, let's hear that story about the big snowstorm.
It was more just being holed up in my sled bag, which they used to have sleds big enough that you could actually get inside of them and sleep for the night. And, you know, I was racing from the village of Teller up there, and hi, everybody in Teller, if anybody's listening. And we used to go out in storms on purpose just to practice for Iditarod. And it was still scary, and I still could have died out there, but basically I was leading the race and got stuck in a snowstorm out in Norton Sound on the sea ice, and we didn't make it all the way across, so the dogs tucked into the snow and got covered up with snow and were nicely insulated, and I got into my sled bag and spent the night out there and was out in the ice like 24 hours. But, you know, you have to know how to do that stuff. It's sometimes too stormy for somebody to come and rescue you, so part of the idea of the Iditarod is you have to know how to take care of yourself. But
Libby, how scary was that at points? I mean, you decided to go into a storm when other mushers decided they weren't going to go into that storm. Was there moments where you thought, yikes, this might be it?
No, it's really interesting, Lori, when you're in a survival situation like that, there's not room in your brain for that kind of thought. For me, there wasn't. It's just you're coping with the situation and totally focused on that. Otherwise, you're cooked meat, I think. But, you know, that's part of what this is all about in a way, too, is just knowing how to survive. That's why there's this pride in doing something like this, because this is part of our culture. It's like knowing how to take care of yourself when you're out there. And for me, it's really a celebration of the native culture. You know, it came up with this whole mode of travel and the people that are comfortable out there traveling. But, you know, still, people die out in these storms all the time, even in modern times. So it's not something just everybody knows how to do. And having the bond with the animals to where you work together to accomplish this and you care for them and they care for you, I mean, there's some good stuff with this.
Well, I think that's an important point when you were saying that you can't let those kind of thoughts enter your mind because, you know, panic or not thinking clearly when you're in a very severe situation could spell doom for you. So that's important that you mm-hmm. noted that you have mm-hmm. to stay calm and trust yourself in those situations.
Yeah, and having practiced out in there too a little bit, but, you know, there's still it's a really fine line. I mean, Elizabeth, you probably had some good stories from out in that cold on the Yukon or other times when you thought it was pretty marginal, I bet, too, huh?
Yeah, I experienced some 60 below weather on the way into Huslia in 2015, and I have experienced quite a bit of cold. I have a pretty good kit. I have a big down parka, and then I have another parka that my mom sewed for me that I put on top of that, and I've been completely warm and comfortable in that and 50 below. But mushing to Huslia, when I could start to feel the cold penetrating those layers, and I have a nose ring, and it's a question I get a lot is, oh, doesn't your nose get cold? Well, no, it doesn't. You know, it's basically part of my face, but on that 60 below run, I could feel my nose ring getting cold, and I knew it was cold outside.
Wow, yeah, I would think that would be something that could freeze a little spot on your nose when it's that cold outside. Do you have to adjust the speed that you're moving when it's that cold, when it's 50, 60 below? Do the dogs have to slow down? Is there danger in sucking in that ultra cold air if they're running really fast?
I think on Iditarod, because they're trotting, they can get away with it, but you don't want to be running sprint races at that temperature.
Lisbeth?
What was the question?
Well, just do you have to slow down the team when it's 50 or 60 below because they're sucking in ultra cold air?
No, I think if anything, you want to get to where you're going in good time. And things are slowed down for you already at those temperatures. Friction increases and your sled drags and things just don't move fast in those cold temperatures. So, mm-hmm. yeah, no, they're okay.
Let's go back to the phones. Marlene is in Deering. Hi, Marlene.
Good morning.
Good morning. Did you have a question?
Bold and fearless here. Anyway, I seen you guys first finish, and I did a lot of Nome, and I started to remember they used to have Governor Collin for a while to congratulate the musher. But the last time they had Governor Collin was when the musher said, "Thank you, sir."
I remember that, Lance. He was all excited from just having one, and he forgot it was Sarah Palin and said, "Sir," because he didn't know, I guess, or forgot. He was so excited, I think. I know what you're talking about, Marlene.
Well, I'm glad you were aware of that story, Libby, because I wasn't clear about what that was. But thanks for the call, Marlene. That's a little bit of funny trivia there from the race one year.
But yeah, usually the governor does call the winner live on the phone, which is kind of nice, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a quintessentially Alaskan thing. That's what I love about it so much. So the CVs, and especially Dallas, has really dominated the story of the Iditarod the last few years. What do you think it'll take to beat Dallas this year? Who wants to take that question?
Getting run over by a pickup truck, perhaps? Who knows? I don't know. I think he's number one on the game right now, although the scuttlebutt before the race was that Mitch actually had the team to beat, which is kind of an interesting comment. So that's what I heard in Anchorage.
Oh, that is interesting. Lisbeth, what's the rumor mill telling you?
Oh, I think the stars will have to align for someone to get out and ahead of Dallas.
Really? What is it that he's doing differently than the other competitive mushers?
He's just got so many things going for him, being young, being from a third-generation mushing family, so he knows it inside out, having competed as a wrestler, you know, all the time he was growing up, competing against his dad, and his dad competing against him so fiercely, you know, having a good family effort, having the money to put in the effort. This new sled he's running was about $10,000, I guess, to put together, and that's nothing to sneeze at, having the capability to do that sort of thing. But, I can't remember who else they were interviewing, but I was in agreement that I think he could possibly win it 10 times, this guy, you know. Time will tell.
Wow. Well, let's let's go back to the phones for a moment. William is in Fairbanks. Hi, William.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest could talk about the difference between mushing on the coast and inland. Do the dogs, if they've been trained out on the coast, do they have any trouble adjusting to trees, for example?
And oh, totally.
I guess there are not many people nowadays who are based out on the coast there, but do the ice conditions make any difference on the dog's feet, so forth? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thanks, William.
Hey, that's a really good question, I think. And from my experience, I've had it from both sides. When I used to just train in the trees at Nelchina, and you'd get out on a big lake, the dogs would sometimes just zig back and forth because they didn't know where to go because the trail wasn't obvious. So if you train in the forest, you have to have your dogs used to also training out on the tundra with the exposed areas and the non-distinct trail and the big winds. But then when I was living and training up in Nome and Teller, people from up there would have the opposite problem. Like, you know, they'd come down in the forest and get lost, and their dogs are crashing into trees and didn't know what they were at first. And, you know, so you have to have all kinds of conditions under the belt for Iditarod, because that's what you're going to get out there, right?
Mm-hmm. And the wind is also something to contend with that's particularly fierce on the coast. And it's hard to train for those sorts of conditions unless you are living close to the coast and those kinds of winds. Those coastal storms are probably the most intimidating thing about Iditarod.
Yeah, you just can't get out of it. And if the musher has not spent much time in it, it's very intimidating mentally to the musher sometimes too, you know, just getting blown all over the place.
It sounds like a lot of it's a mind game for sure, that you have to keep yourself when you're out there all alone, just sort of revved up and psyched up and give yourself your own pep talks to keep going in these extreme conditions. We are talking about the Iditarod today on Talk of Alaska with Libby Riddles, past race champion, and Lisbeth Norris, who will find out if she plans to compete again in the near future. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue on with more questions and possibly some of your questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center's statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the Iditarod today. And as I mentioned at the top of the program, Lance Mackey was supposed to be on with us. Libby Riddles is on the program with us today, and so is Lisbeth Norris. Lance Mackey was supposed to be on with us as well, but unfortunately he's homesick today and couldn't join us. He's not racing this year, but Lance spoke with Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes yesterday in Fairbanks at the start of the race. And here's a bit of that interview.
I'm just curious what you're watching for your dogs on your brother's team this year and how you're going to be keeping an eye on things.
Oh, I have dogs in a lot of teams here. I'm going to keep an eye on everybody. But, I have no predictions. I have no expectations. But, undoubtedly I'm missing it. Hopefully I'll be at the end to see him come in. And, we'll see how it goes from there. But I'm here to support all of them and just let my dogs know that I'm still part of, I'm supporting them. And it's the right thing to do for the dogs. This ain't about me.
How are you though right now?
I could probably burst into tears instantly. And I ain't gonna lie, I have several times, just not in front of anybody. This is my life. And something that I've occasionally been really good at. And, obviously I can't change a lot of things, so I have to accept a lot of things. There goes the dog team by itself. And that in itself is something I haven't gotten used to. I haven't accepted the fact that I can't change the things that I'm not able to change, So I have to accept them. And right at the moment, I'm still having a hard time accepting them because in my mind, I can do anything I want. And unfortunately, I can't, So a lot of accepting. A lot of accepting.
Lance Mackey humbly reflecting on his love of his dogs and sort of a sad acceptance of not racing this year. You can hear more of Lance and other Iditarod news and tales from the trail in the Iditapod. It's available on alaskapublic.org, iTunes, or Stitcher. So let's talk for a moment about some of this year's rule changes and what you think of them. There were two changes put in place this year. Mushers can't carry dogs in a pull-behind trailer. What prompted this change, and what do you think it'll mean for mushers?
You want to go, Liz?
Sure. So that was a preemptive rule change. They amended the rules. There was some concern about, so carrying dogs in trailers was getting more and more popular. And there was some concern about the dogs bumping around in the back of a trailer. You can't, easily see them and see what's going on with them. So before anything could happen, they decided to amend the rule. So now a dog needs to be carried attached to the main sled. You can still carry a trailer with gear and supplies. You just can't haul dogs in it. So the thinking is that you'll have a dog either right underneath you or right ahead of you so that you can check on its condition. It's just a bit of oversight.
Libby, do you have thoughts to add to that?
Well, I was just interested ever since they put the rule out how people would adapt to it. And I was trying to foresee then they might go back to a longer sled and be able to carry dogs because it's kind of brilliant and really a way to be able to. Actually, Bud Smith was the first one tried this out on a bigger scale way back when. But but having some dogs rested out, like there's some conditions where you're just standing on your brake for hours trying to pace your dogs down to a trot, and instead of doing that, you just take a few dogs out, rest them. You're going slower, so you don't have to stand on your brake. Yeah, then you have the nice fresh dogs and can rest. And you know, so there's controversy about it. No doubt, in some ways, just being able to rest the dogs. But I think right now it's a pretty good strategy. As long as it's done safely, is good for the dogs.
And then the second change, we had an email from William Forsberg, who is also asking about the changes, the permission to use a cell phone or other two-way communications is also allowed on the trail this year. That was something that was verboten before the tragedy last year when a drunk snow machiner slammed into Jeff King's team, killing one of his dogs and injuring another so badly that it had to retire from racing. Allie Zirkel was also attacked by the same person and had to use a trail marker stick to sort of fend him off. The safety rationale is clear in that instance, but do any of you worry, or do either of you worry about the use of such technology, cell or satellite phones on the trail, that it could give mushers an unfair advantage somehow? Libby, I'll start with you.
Well, if everybody has the same thing going on, then it's equal for everybody, but personally, I think it's crazy. I don't think it's really in the spirit of the Iditarod, is my own feeling, but then I'm not queen of the world and I didn't make the rule. So, you know, I'm just now, you know, just watching to see this year, you know, how it plays out. And, ideally, they're not supposed to have coaching with the phone, but how are you ever going to oversee that? Like, just to know where everybody else is on the trail by having somebody with a GPS tracker call and tell you. You know, that part I don't like. The part that might be fun, though, is getting information from people who are getting the calls and then getting a little bit more insight of what's going on out there. I've also heard that reception's bad. How are they going to charge these things? Yada, yada. So I'm just like everybody else, just kind of waiting to see how it'll shake out.
Elizabeth, what are your thoughts about this?
I'm not a fan of the rule change. I think it's a completely unenforceable rule. And, I mean, of course, there's a lot of aspects to races and competitions that rely on sportsmanly-like conduct. But with these cell phones, there is no way to ensure whether someone is not being coached. I think the arguments against cell phones in that, oh, there's poor reception or you can't charge them, I think that comes from a generation that doesn't have a great grasp on technology and the satellite capabilities of phones, and you can charge your phone with your headlight. Like, I have a USB charger for my my headlight. Like, you can keep a device charged all the way down the trail. You can have a sat phone addition to your iPhone to, like, enable it to be a satellite phone. I liked the CV's idea that they put forth of allowing mushers to carry a sat phone in case of emergency, but have it wrapped up in some sort of seal.
Sealed, yeah.
Like a sealed safety thing. But it's also can provide a false sense of security. You know, the same with the button on the trackers, the help button. I mean, you cannot guarantee that someone is going to be able to come out and rescue you at any point. Like, it could take hours and hours for someone to be able to reach wherever you are. Like, it's not you need to be able to take care of yourself out there.
That's a really interesting point, that it may cause this false sense of security. I mean, we're certainly talking about people who are tough enough to be in this race, and that's no small thing. But I can see the concern going forward that that you're raising here. And what happened with the idea of having a sealed phone that just wasn't accepted by the Iditarod Trail Committee?
Who knows? It might have been too complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Stephanie is in Fairbanks. Hi, Stephanie.
Hey. Hi, you guys. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Do you have a question?
I just wanted to bop back to somebody mentioned village dogs when you guys were talking about sled dogs and the genetics, where they come from, because I'm a big proponent of village dogs all over the world, and it's a study for me. And so I just wanted to say that these dogs in Alaska, and we can prove it with the genetic studies, all come from indigenous dogs from Alaska and Canada. And we
have I've read some of those studies that you're talking about, and where they tested some of the top dogs, and it's kind of almost too bad because they all get mixed up with the racing hounds and everything else, and harder to find kind of more pure village strains. But DNA testing is kind of interesting.
We just have the village dogs, and it's not a pure land race anymore. But we try to keep it to the original. You know, idea of the dogs where they're really tough. They don't need coats. They don't need booties. They can either race or work. They're very ambidextrous. They're great with kids, and you don't have to worry about them when it goes 50 below. Mm-hmm. And I'm sad that people got away from that and went to go straight to speed only, because it kind of genetically limits their intelligence and everything else, their toughness, and they're plenty fast, believe me.
That's why it's really neat in a way to have the race going through Nenana, Tanana, Hooslea, Koyukuk, all those areas. I mean, of course, I'm from the coast, so I'm kind of prejudiced towards those dogs, but, I mean, geez, we're talking the heart of Alaska sled dogs back in there, and just where a lot of the best dog breeds came from. But it's interesting to me to study the history, you know, and see that here a Belgian shepherd from a steamboat on the Yukon was added in, and we had old John Earl Komok and Teller go through the breed book and finally figured out it was a foxhound that he bred in with his old breeds. And, you know, it's always been kind of a mix, and it's just interesting to see how it evolves, don't you think? I mean, and I think, Lisbeth, too, that's why sometimes people breed back to the purebreds, because that's almost got, like, the same kind of toughness as the village dog, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. When mushers talk about what they want in a good racing husky, they want good feet, good coat, good appetite, and instinct to run. And those four characteristics describe a Siberian husky to a T.
Yeah, doesn't Booser breed in a Siberian every once in a while? And I think some of these guys
Not in a long time, he hasn't.
Well, I've heard of that anyway, so.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Stephanie, for raising the issue of some of the origins of the strains and the toughness of village dogs. That was a good conversation. Let's stay with the phones for a moment and go to Joan in Bird Creek. Hi, Joan.
Hi there. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Joan.
Hey, I think you are sort of undertelling your story of being out on the ice and climbing into your sled bag. What I recall was after you got in there finally and got zipped in, that you realized you were sweaty to the bone, and you unzipped everything and took off all your clothes and changed into dry clothes inside the sled bag.
That's the long version of the story. But, you know, I found out camping. One time my Norwegian friends were visiting me up in Teller, and we did a three-dog team trip from Teller to Nome. And that country between there is tougher than anything on the Iditarod, if you ask me. And we got all sweated up because there was no snow on the road. And I tried to sleep that night in wet clothes, and I didn't almost die, but I was so uncomfortable I kind of wished I did. So I learned my lesson, and so then I was out on the race, and I knew I had to do that because same kind of thing. I had to be walking up in front of the dogs to find the trail and the marker and then walk back, you know, and so I was kind of sweated up, and, you know, that's a good way to die out there. So if it takes 2 hours to get dry clothes on, that's what it takes. Well, at least I was smart and had dry clothes. So anyway, thanks,
Joan. That's the real grit there.
Yeah, well, thank you.
That was something.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Joan. That's an important point. Being sweaty when it's 50 below zero is not a good idea at all, because hypothermia certainly can set in fast. This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and we're discussing the Iditarod today with past champion Libby Riddles and Lisbeth Norris, who is a competitor and also a third-generation musher and dog breeder here in Alaska. Libby, tell us what it was like to be a woman running the race as a rookie in 1980.
People didn't really pay too much attention to who you were until you go out and prove yourself. And I went out and came in 18th place that year. I had a little respect, I think. But it's something I like about Alaska, is it seems kind of democratic that way in a lot of ways. But it's kind of neat now. Like, if you watch the Rondi and see Roxy win and even beat Buddy Streeper, I didn't even hear once, oh, a woman wins the Rondi, because nobody even thinks twice about it. But I do kind of think that this is a good year for women racers. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for some of those top lady racers up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Lisbeth, I'd ask you to jump in too. Libby, it makes it sound as if there hasn't been a whole lot of misogyny or chauvinism towards women in mushing. What's been your experience about how attitudes toward women in the race have been, and maybe how they've changed?
No, I don't think you see a lot of that. I think ultimately we're all dog people. Our dogs come first. I think one of the reasons we haven't seen a lot of women mushers in the race, historically speaking, is from a socioeconomic standpoint. I think a lot of the jobs and occupations that lend itself to being able to pursue mushing and training for Iditarod full time have typically been male-dominated industries. Like, it's a real ordeal to be able to put together the finances in order to field an Iditarod race team, to be able to take the time off of work or take time, and there's an argument that, taking time away from the family is also rough, but times are changing, and I think, women are gaining a better economic foothold in relation to men, and you're seeing more and more women enter the race.
All right. Thanks so much for that. We're talking with Libby Riddles and Lisbeth Norris about the Iditarod today. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Suzanne is in Kotzebue. Hi, Suzanne.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Evans. I'd like to reminisce of my grandpa, Charlie Evans, who was a 1925 Victoria Thurman musher. And my grandpa used to always talk about the 1925 Victoria Thurman when we were kids going to Galena for Christmas. It was very heartwarming, and I also got to meet my uncle, Edgar Nalmer. He's my grandpa's brother-in-law. They also
cool.
I just wanted to say happy trails and top face coverings to all the mushers that are going out to mushers and homes. And also watch that movie, Icebound, that's been made here in Alaska by the late producer, Johnny Anker, and also my uncle, Dick Evans, and Patty Mama, and we helped the late Johnny Anker make it. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Yeah, thanks,
cool.
Suzanne.
I got to meet Edgar Nolner. He was the last one of the original serum runners. That's what she was talking about. A little hard to understand with the phone, Noah.
Yeah, it was a little difficult to understand, but thanks so much for the call, Suzanne. And we are going to take another quick break, but when we come back, I want to ask you, Libby, you had mentioned that you went in the 90s on part of the kind of the rerunning of that serum run, and so we'll talk a little bit about that, and then about what both of you ladies are up to with your businesses these days as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone.
Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the Iditarod today. One question that I wanted to get to before we talk about the future and what you're doing, also Libby and Lisbeth, is how much do your fans influence you? What's it like to have that sort of external support?
Oh, I don't know. For me, it's just like the connection of, you know, that I see all the time of just people giving me the feedback that they think it's inspirational what I've done. I mean, I'm glad to be able to have that effect on people. Otherwise, I don't think about it too awful much, but I just like the connection of the whole Iditarod family, you know, all the people all around that get excited about it and help out with it and run it. I mean, that's what it's like to me, is a big family.
Lisbeth?
Well, for me, it's huge. I wouldn't be able to do Iditarod financially without the support of fans and sponsors. And there are a lot of Siberian Husky fans that have supported me in my races, like people that like to see the dogs on the trail. And I also am in this really unique position in that I can be an educator and a representative for the sport, and I really love sharing my passion for the dogs and nature and mushing with people.
And let's talk a little bit about how you've expanded on a lifelong love of these things that you grew up with. You've stepped away from the Iditarod this year, Lisbeth, to focus on your new sled dog business. Tell us about it. And then, Libby, I know that you also are involved in some of these things. So, Lisbeth, start with your business, and then Libby will talk about yours.
Sure. So I moved back to Fairbanks this fall, and my partner, Nils Pedersen, and I bought a beautiful little homestead just north of Fairbanks. And we put in a dog yard, and I started up a little ecotourism mushing business. And we focus on multi-day dog trips and sled dog supported expeditions. We also do tours from, you know, 2-hour tours. And it's been a dream of mine. Like, I've been thinking about this for 7 years, and it's been very exciting and fulfilling for me to focus on this business and share the dogs with people. And I've also been just really enjoying this kind of laid back approach to mushing. Like, the concept that my business is centered on is rustic luxury. Like, travel by dog team, you know, affords you a certain level of comfort that's difficult to obtain, you know, if you have to carry something on your back or haul it yourself. And so, you know, we travel with an Arctic oven tent. It has a wood stove. You know, they're famous for being 70 degrees when it's 40 below outside. We have, you know, real meals that we can cook in there and twinkle lights. And it's just a fantastic experience, especially for, you know, coming from the race scene. You know, I don't pack a tent. Like, the 15
minutes. And
you don't
pack twinkle lights, I'm sure.
Well, no, I got a headlight. blows those out of the water. But, you know, like, you know, coming from, you can, you know, running Iditarod, if you're real efficient, you maybe get, you know, two-hour naps a day, four hours of sleep a day and brief spurts, and having, you know, exploring interior of Alaska with the dog team and setting up camp. Like, I'm just really enjoying this method of travel and enjoying the opportunity to see the state in a new way share that with folks.
It sounds like an awesome experience. And Libby, what are you doing now? Tell us about what you're involved in. And then also, after you tell us about your own adventures and endeavors, I know that you wanted to mention this new George Atlas.
The nonprofit deal in
nonprofit.
The school. Yeah. But yeah, sometimes I really miss racing, all right, just the intensity of it. But the job I have is great for somebody who's used to intense, because I'm doing like 120 shows every summer for Princess Cruises down in Juneau on the ships while they're in port. And I've been doing this for quite a long time here now. It's very intense schedule. I love doing it, though, because I love being somebody who can teach people about the race and get them excited about it and help bring all these fans to the race. So people will go on an excursion, like I helped start the heli-mushing camps up on the glacier in Juneau, which is like one of the top tours in Alaska. Did it for 3 years, and then I decided to get into something less complicated. But people will do that in the morning and then come see my show at night, buy some books and this and that, and then you got another sled dog racing fan there. And half the time it's their kids that have found out about it in school, and then they get their parents excited and everybody kind of wants to check it out. So I love that part of it, being you know, keeping up on it, like doing the coverage for the start of the race. And I always follow all the races. I love the Rondi and the North American and the Yukon Quest, and I follow all those races.
And tell us about the nonprofit that's the following after George Atla's legacy.
This is something that you know, George Atla, the Spirit of the Wind, one of Alaska's best ever mushers. He passed away a few years ago, and in his later part of his life, him and Kathy Turco, his partner, were working on getting a sled dog program into the schools. And Kathy has just kept after this like a bulldog, Kathy Turco, and they finally got a really good grant for this. And Arlie Reynolds, who's got the veterinary school up in Fairbanks, the sled dog champ, Hugh Neff, the couple mushers involved in this, and they're going to get this mushing and cultural program throughout a lot of these villages in that Huslia school district area, and then have access for other school districts to pick up on the plan, too. And it's also spearheaded by, Pete McManus was a famous musher from up north, died in a plane crash, I'm pretty sure it was from Ambler, and his son, who now lives in Tok, is kind of another person who's spearheaded all of this. But they can go to atlamakingofachampion.com for more information on this whole program that's so great. So big kudos to Kathy and the rest of the crew for getting this going.
All right. And in our last about 40 seconds here, I had an email question asking about what kind of stoves mushers use and the fuel that they use.
Gosh, you might know better than me. You get that one.
Lisbeth?
Yeah, they're alcohol-based stoves. They run on heat, and the technology really hasn't changed much in the last 30 years, Libby.
That's kind of what I thought, so.
Yeah, you put your fuel in the bottom of a stove. It's, you know, can be a 5-gallon bucket, and light it on fire, and you put a water pan on top of it, and melt snow or heat up some water to feed your dogs.
Yeah, it's hard to improve on because it's so simple. We used to use Coleman stoves when I started.
Oh,
they were
gosh,
a pain.
Wow. Yeah, the alcohol burns no matter the temperature. It may take a little bit longer at 40 below, but you don't have to worry about the gas freezing.
Well, thank you both so much. I really appreciate your time and your love of the sport and sharing it with all of us today. Libby Riddles on the phone from Homer and Lisbeth Norris from in the studios at KUAC. We were hoping to have Lance Mackey on with us today, but he's homesick, so best wishes to Lance. We hope you feel better really quick. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.